Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 11, 2003. And this is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And of course, September 11th, a very resonant date. And I'm not talking about the coup against Allende in Chile. That was 30 years ago, wasn't it? But I'm talking, of course, about the destruction of the World Trade Center and the damaging of the Pentagon 2 years ago today. And I thought about what to do on the show in remembrance of that, if anything. The endless repetition of the of wounded American narcissism is not a pretty sight always, and God knows it was certainly what happened 2 years ago was a crime and a tragedy and a horror, but crimes and tragedies and horrors happen to many people around the world, and Americans don't seem to be care too much about those when they happen to other people, but we act as if when they happen to us, we're very special, and it's just not fair. It shouldn't happen to anybody, and especially it shouldn't happen to people using American power and American money, as it often happens. But anyway, I decided to observe the day slightly off kilter. First, I'll talk to Rita Shera of the Century Foundation about American public opinion around George Bush and the war on terror. Then about 20 minutes after, we'll speak with Nicole Spelda, who is the project director of the Global Attitudes Project at the Pew Center for People and the Press, which has been surveying people around the world about their opinions about many, many things, including their attitudes towards the United States. We'll talk to her about that, and also their attitude towards globalization, which is not, whatever that word means exactly, but it's not anywhere near as negative as a lot of people might assume. And then finally, we'll talk to Leslie Kaufman, who is an organizer with United for Peace and Justice, about activism these days, the anti-globalization movement or the anti-corporate globalization movement or the global justice movement, what UFPJ is doing in the run-up to the Cancun WTO summit, and also just the issue of activism in general these days. It's not terribly easy, but there was that anti-war movement, and so we'll talk about the relation between that and the global justice movement and other things that UFPJ is involved with. Time is very short, so just a couple of observations of the economic news. Last week's U.S. employment report was pretty awful. I said this time a week ago that we're expecting a mildly flat to positive number in the total count of employed or jobs in the U.S., and I was not alone in that feeling, but it seemed like the labor market was stabilizing and we might see an end to the six consecutive months of job loss that we'd seen up till then, but alas, it was not good news at all. A loss of 93,000 jobs in the month of August. There were no comforts below the surface of that headline number. The only reason the unemployment rate dropped from 6.2 to 6.1% is that a lot of people left the labor force and are no longer counted as unemployed. That's not a good sign. Industry sectors, almost every major industry sector shrunk its employment. Number of hours that people put in on the job, those who are employed who have jobs, weekly hours were down or were actually at an all-time record low for the nearly 40 years the government's been publishing those numbers every month. And earnings per hour and per week are weakening substantially. So not good news at all. And this morning it was reported that first-time claims for unemployment insurance last week rose against all expectations. We're back well above the 400,000 mark, which is considered the dividing line between a recessionary economy and a recovering economy. So we're on the wrong side of that again after some improvement in the spring and early and summer. And also, just a word about Argentina. I want to find somebody to talk about the Argentine deal with the IMF next week. But Argentina did make a deal with the IMF, and it was, from Argentina's point of view, a pretty good deal. The IMF did get a promise of a fairly large budget surplus, but the IMF also wanted an increase in electric utility rates, and that was not part of the agreement. The IMF also wanted compensation to investors for forced deposit payments to depositors, and that didn't happen. And nothing in the agreement about paying up arrears to the IMF. So a pretty good deal for Argentina as far as these things go. But we'll talk to someone next week about this in more detail. And let's just bring it to a close there because I've got a full plate of guests tonight, and who needs to hear much more of me? First, Reed Teixeira, who is a public opinion expert at the Century Foundation, and he produces something called, I can't remember the exact name of it, but he does produce a weekly review of polling numbers that's available at the Century Foundation website. That's century.org, century.org. He's really one of the best analysts of polls around. He can take numbers and turn them into English. So, in an interview recorded earlier today, here's Reed Teixeira on... I meant to set this up because the first question segues from this. Bush's approval rating right after 9/11, 2 years ago, was over 80, not quite as high as his father got during the first Gulf War, but very high, according to Gallup. They then started decaying and then bounced again at the beginning of the Iraq War in March to somewhere in the 70s, and they've been falling ever since, and now they're hovering in the high 50s, which is a little below where Clinton was when he left office. So he's doing reasonably well in his approval rating, but nowhere near what he was doing a couple of years ago. So let's talk to Reed Teixeira about what that all means.
We've heard the trajectory of the Gallup approval ratings. What do you make of this?
Well, I think one thing we now know is that, as a number of people predicted before the war in Iraq, the spike that Bush was going to get in his approval rating from the war wasn't going to be as big as the one he got from September 11th or his father got from the first Gulf War, and it probably wasn't going to be as long-lasting. And that certainly turned out to be true. His spike from the war was in the nature of maybe 11 or 12 points, depending on the poll. He's lost all of that and more since the tanks rolled into Baghdad. And now he's sinking down, not just below 60, as the Gallup poll shows, but at least it's worth considering it. Might be much lower than that at this point, because most of the other public polls tend to have him about in the mid-50s or even in the low 50s.
What accounts for the difference between Gallup and the others?
Good question. If I knew the answer, I'd tell my buddy Keating Holland at CNN, who works on the CNN Gallup USA Today poll, and he could fix it. But he's puzzled, too. He doesn't quite get it. But that's just the pattern that we've been seeing in the last period of time, that they come in high. The Washington Post also tends to come in high for whatever reason. So,
but at least it's a consistent poll over time that they ask the question pretty frequently, so at least we have.
Yeah. I mean, and the pattern is basically similar. The Gallup poll tended to have them a bit higher at his peak during the Iraq War than other polls, and now they still got him a bit higher. But the pattern's the same, that he's lost all of his approval gains from the war and then some.
And what does this approval number really mean? Does it translate into electoral success, or is it kind of an abstract feeling number that may not affect behavior?
Well, it's a pretty good predictor of electoral success with this caveat. It really is important close to the election. At this point, an approval rating doesn't mean that much in terms of predicting success in an election 14 months away. What's going to be important is to look at it in the summer of 2004 and see what it looks like. Right now, it doesn't have much predictive power.
But it does seem that Bush is losing some of his aura of invincibility, isn't it, and drawing some criticism now, finally.
Sure. What the approval rating always tended to show when it was pretty high was that despite people having huge questions about his economic management and thinking that the way he'd handled various important domestic issues to not only maybe wasn't good, but kind of sucked. It reflected the fact that people still were cutting him a lot of slack as president, as commander-in-chief, reflecting the post-9/11 political environment and their sense that he was a good leader of the struggle against terror and for national security. And clearly that's eroded quite a bit. And obviously not just the economy is doing that, but the big mess in Iraq, which turned out a lot worse than most people expected it to, certainly than Bush said it would, has really made him take a hit.
Now, it was said a few months ago that Bush was probably invincible on national security issues, but was vulnerable on economic issues, and now we're seeing that people are even saying that he's vulnerable on security issues. How do you rate that?
Oh, I think that's unquestionably true, that he's vulnerable. I mean, I would say it's still true the Republicans overall have an advantage on the issue, but it's no longer as, you know, insurmountable as it once was. If you looked at the 2002 election, there's a famous Stanley Greenberg statistic that showed the Republicans are favored over the Democrats by 40 points on the issue of keeping America strong right on the eve of the election. And that kind of sentiment accounts a lot for the gains the Republicans made in 2002. In the most recent Greenberg poll for Democracy Corps, it's down to 16 points, so it's been more than cut in half. And people like me have been saying for a long time, if the Democrats can open up a pretty big lead on the economy, which now looks to be about 15 points in some polls, and they can cut the GOP advantage in national security in half or more, they'd have a real shot at Bush in 2004, and that's already happened. So, I mean, it's clearly a competitive ball game. Though, again, I don't wish to say the Democrats now have an advantage of national security, but they're at least playing on the same field.
Brove and Bush and the gang have been masterful at creating this master narrative of terrorism. Everything is sort of subordinated to that, and they've been fairly successful at putting many, many things under that rubric. Is there any way to challenge that master narrative, as the theorists say?
I think there is. Certainly they are sticking with their story. There was a very funny article in the Washington Post today about how often Bush invokes 9/11 and in what context. And, you know, he invokes it in everything from a Labor Day speech to talking about education to, of course, anything even vaguely related to foreign policy. I mean, he'd talk about 9/11 if he was talking about preschool for kids. I mean, it's just, it's the one thing he has to talk about that he thinks trumps everything else. But I think one reason why he's vulnerable now is the sense that we aren't that much safer than we were at 9/11, that he had a strategy for dealing with terror that turns out not to have been all that effective. We're now involved in the Iraq mess. People are very worried about the fact that we're doing all of this on our own, and we don't have any help, and it's costing a lot of money. American people are pragmatic. As long as his strategy seemed to be working, people would cut him a huge amount of slack, especially in light of, you know, his perceived leadership abilities after 9/11. But now people look at what's going on and they say, does this guy really know what he's doing? This doesn't seem to be working too well. Maybe we need a change of course, and so on. So it doesn't make the Democrats' job a slam dunk or anything, but it does mean that they can exploit these doubts that are already in the minds of the public and these questions that they have to develop their own counter-narrative, as it were, if we want to use those kind of phrases. But, are they there yet? Probably not, but, it's 14 months to the election, and they got a lot of good raw material, so we'll see what they can come up with.
One thing that consistently mystifies me is how this guy who went AWOL from ROTC manages to wear, the flight suit and claim the mantle of commander-in-chief so convincingly in the eyes of so much of the American public. Do you have any insight into that?
Well, I think that's fairly easy to explain in the sense that I think most of it is accounted for by people's reluctance to criticize Bush and anything to do with the military post 9/11. I mean, there are certainly hard questions that can be asked about his history and vis-a-vis the military and the extent to which he might be exploiting these kind of symbols for his own political gain. But I think we're just actually now getting into a political environment where you can actually raise some of these issues, at least obliquely, and not worry about being targeted for being unpatriotic and totally not with the program of the war against terror. Have people been, Democrats particularly, been too timid about this in the past? Probably, but to some extent they were just responding to a very real political environment that made it difficult. But I think the environment's shifting, and I think now some of these hard questions can be asked, and some of these sort of nasty stories, as it were, can come to the fore, and maybe hurt Bush. We'll see. Certainly someone like John Kerry would be in a good position to raise those kinds of issues about military service.
I'm speaking with Reed Teixeira, who is a public opinion expert at the Century Foundation. There's a real hardcore of people, and not necessarily small a number, of people who really, really hate Bush. And I don't recall anything like that about his father, certainly, and even not really so much about Reagan. There are certainly a lot of people who didn't like him, but I think there's more of a passionate intensity of dislike towards this guy. Is this how common a phenomenon is this in American politics, and what impact might it have?
Well, it's hard to measure this issue of how much people hate Bush. If you're just talking about partisan polarization, in some ways this has been more the rule than the exception in American politics in the last few decades. Democrats tend to vigorously support Democrats, Republicans support Republicans, and there's a lot of polarization between the parties and their supporters. And certainly we see that that's been ramped up a little bit from the 2000 election, when things were a bit more confused. But I don't think it's without precedent in American politics. What's harder to measure is this sense you're getting at, that people just totally detest Bush. And there's a lot of real anger at the Bush and even at the Democratic Party itself for not standing up to him. And, you know, it kind of has built ever since the 2000 election, and people sense that election was stolen from the Democrats, and the Democrats did not put up a good fight. And then, you know, this kind of naked political gain that the Republicans appear to have indulged in from 9/11 and the way they ran the 02 election, and then, you know, the big tax cuts, and, you know, I could go on and on. You could, a lot of your listeners could, and people sense this guy is just pushing a hard right agenda, and he has a political machine that has no morals, that has no scruples, that doesn't even follow any of our, what people take to be our standard political norms. And so that has generated an intensity of feeling that does appear to be real, but is a little bit hard to capture with poll data.
We saw certainly a very heavily partisan anti-Clinton feeling, and now, of course, we see this very partisan anti-Bush feeling. At the same time, we hear that party attachment in general is weakening. How do you reconcile that?
Well, actually, there's quite a bit of dispute about that in political science. I mean, it's clear that the number of independents have risen somewhat, and a lot, depending on the question. If you just ask people, are you Democrat, Republican, or independent, there's a lot more independents than there used to be. But if you push them a little bit and see what party they lean toward, the change in the number of independents is actually more modest. So people's attachment to parties are still there. And there's actually a book written by a couple of Yale professors which basically argues that partisanship is just about as strong as it's ever been, and it's the key predictor variable for how you behave politically. And in fact, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So I guess I'm less sure than a lot of people that parties don't mean what they used to. I mean, there may have been some diminution, but they're still of huge importance to how people survey the political world and certainly to how they vote.
The rap in American elections is that, or at least one rap, is that they've been mostly determined by domestic and economic kinds of issues, and that foreign policy was not a major consideration among the masses the way it is among elites. 9/11, of course, made an exception to that, but how likely is it, do you think, we'll see a reversion to that kind of much more domestic determination of political fights?
Well, certainly the farther we get from 9/11, the more likely it is we are to have elections that are basically determined by domestic issues. But I don't think we're likely to get back to the 90s atmosphere very soon, when foreign policy just appeared to be of no importance whatsoever. I think it's going to continue to be of fairly significant importance, and a lot depends on whether we do or do not have terrorist incidents on U.S. soil, and just generally how the world situation evolves and how it's perceived by the public. So I think that it'll still come to be of a fair amount of importance throughout this decade, though I think it will probably fade over time. And, generally, that's got to be good for the Democrats, because even if they become more competitive on national security issues, which I think they are and they will continue to do, their great advantage lies in the fact that most members of the public support a more democratic or pro-government approach to public policy in the United States than they support the hard-right agenda of the GOP. So, in a sense, that's been papered over by the whole national security issue and the way the Republicans have been exploiting it. The more that fades, the more the underlying tendencies of the public that favor the Democrats will come out.
A couple of weeks ago, Andrew Cohut from the Pew Center said that he thought that if there were another terrorist attack on U.S. soil, it's possible that people would blame Bush and that he wouldn't get the same rally around the flag effect. What do you think of that?
Boy, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you could argue it either way. I mean, you could argue that something happens, just people will disregard any cognitive processing of why this happened and just immediately rally around the president. But certainly there's a non-trivial possibility, and some people would argue probability, that people will look at this and say, my God, what have we been doing for the last few years? You know, why the hell were we in Iraq? And I thought the war on terror was about stopping these kinds of things from happening, and it looks like the current administration dropped the ball. So you could certainly make an argument that rather than get a rally around the flag effect, you'll get a, you know, throw the bums out and let this happen effect. I mean, I hope to hell it doesn't happen, and I hope we never get to test that one. But I certainly think it's possible that this could collapse the Bush House of Cards on national security.
And finally, if you were advising one of the Democratic candidates, what would you think is a good strategy? Where is the president vulnerable, and what kind of platform could they win on?
Oh, boy, well, that's a huge issue. I mean, I certainly think one of the things they've got to get right is this whole issue we've just been talking about with national security. I think a Democratic candidate should, if not run against the war, run on, you know, this whole thing has been mismanaged, and be fairly brutal toward Bush and how badly things have turned out, and, you know, where is Osama bin Laden? What was the original objective of this war, this alleged war? And, you know, really go at him pretty heavily and put a lot of emphasis on sort of rebuilding our relations with other countries so that we can fight terror more effectively. I think Democrats can't ignore this issue. They have to engage it in it vigorously. On the domestic front, I think you clearly go after the Bush tax cuts and repeal at least the parts of them that go to the rich, call for that, and then take that money and put it into effective economic stimulus, invest in education and other things. I think it would be a mistake, however, to just repeal the tax cuts or some part of them and then try to balance the budget, or repeal the tax cuts and some part of them and just, you know, give away additional tax cuts. I think Democrats need to put some concrete programs up against the Bush wasting of the money on the rich. So, I mean, that's in broad brush how I'd approach it. I mean, the devil's in the details on these things, and I hope to hell whoever gets nominated figures them out.
All right, well, thanks for joining us, Ree.
Sure, thanks.
And that was Ree Teixeira, interview recorded earlier today. Ree Teixeira is a fellow at the Century Foundation in Washington, D.C., expert on public opinion, and we'll be back after this word from Dmitry Shostakovich. An excerpt from Dmitri Shostakovich's Prelude No. 1 in C major, performed by Keith Jarrett on the piano. And now we're joined by Nicole Spalda, who is project director for the Global Attitudes Project at the Pew Center for the People and the Press in Washington, D.C. Welcome to WBAI.
Hello.
Hi, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
I didn't hear you say it.
I said Spalda, is that
right? Yes.
Okay. The Pew Center does a lot of polling, both in the United States and around the world, and you've been doing a lot of polling around the world on global attitudes on many, many topics, including attitudes towards the U.S. So let's talk a bit about what you've found comparing, say, attitude towards the U.S. 3-4 years ago with what we're seeing today and what bearing the war in Iraq had on these attitudes.
Right. Well, starting what we basically have published, the benchmark survey was begun in 1999 and 2000. And the U.S., we have a pretty favorable view. in most places around the world, with the exception of Pakistan and Palestinian Authority. But for the most part, it had pretty high ratings, and as in places you would expect, our allies in Europe, and Britain, for example, and in Germany and France, talking about in the 70 percentile, the 62% favorable in France and 50% in Spain. And what we found in the summer of 2002 was that that dropped a little bit, and our numbers picked that up, but it was not an appreciable difference in those locations. And leading up to the war in Iraq, we saw a big dip in March. Places that were our allies, our longtime friends, really went down considerably. There was a large drop in Germany, going from 2000 at 78% favorable to 25% favorable. In France, from 62% favorable to 31%. And even our closest allies, the British, went from 83% to 48% favorable. Now, that pre-war dip did come up a bit. We pulled again in May, and those numbers did jump up to reflect some sort of post-war bounce, I guess you could call it. So we've seen kind of the U.S. go through a definitely a dip in favorability ratings. And, you know, we even do have some numbers from back when the State Department was surveying, and in the early 1990s, and all the levels had stayed fairly consistent with those high levels in Europe, but they've gone down everywhere. That's the story.
And in a lot of cases, even though there's been a bounce back since March, the numbers look to be well below where they were in 1999-2000. Germany, for example, 78% favorable rating in 3-4 years ago. And now, well, it bottomed out at 25% in March, and now we're back up to 45.
That's right. Yeah.
France, the move is a little less dramatic, but similar pattern.
Right. That's all a pattern around the world, actually. The numbers have not come back up. There are definitely some sentiments from the war that are continuing on, and these are big issues to talk about. I mean, at worst, we've got, you know, in some places around the world, it's probably most troubling in the Muslim world. We're talking about people who we have 1% favorability ratings in places like Jordan and the Palestinian Authority. So it's troubling. It is troubling.
I'm speaking with Nicole Spalda, who is the project director of the Global Attitudes Project at the Pew Center for People and the Press. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News. Is it all the war, or are there other things, too? What about Kyoto and the general syndrome that is identified as Bush's unilateralism?
Yeah, what we found was, and it's not all negative, These favorability ratings have gone down mostly because of United States policies. And this is, as you said, part of, the Kyoto Protocol. The U.S. And particularly Europe have different viewpoints of the International Criminal Court. There are many foreign policy issues that divide the U.S. from the rest of the world. And the biggest probably being the United States policy towards Israel, and the ways in which we go about conflict resolution there. So it's the policy differences that we see that are creating most of the tension here. The overall attitudes. There are some things that stay constant that the U.S. and Europe will always sort of share. But what's created this great rift beyond Europe even are U.S. policies.
And how much is this shift? Well, you mentioned U.S. policies, but is this perceived as something very specific to the Bush administration, or is there a sense that the U.S. has collectively gone mad?
Well, we did ask the question twice. you know, do you think this is a big problem with America in general, or do you think it's a problem with President Bush? And, you know, Europeans don't like Bush. It's not a secret. And that's the answer we got, was, you know, it's a Bush problem. It's a policy problem that has to do with Bush. And, you know, we also, something that is not very publicized that we ask always in our surveys is, you know, how do you feel about the American people? And, you know, when asked that, it's not all negative. The American people still get, you know, fairly high ratings.
A lot of the people you poll probably have relatives who live here, right?
Well, certainly. you know, or other ties to people that, you know, we get along like any other, you know, civilized, just one-on-one people talking together. But, it, you know, so yes, we have found Bush to be a problem all around the world, except, and this is actually an extremely interesting finding, except in South Korea. That was the only country that...
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that, given you know, the length of U.S. ties to South Korea. They're not too fond of us. What's that about?
We released something a couple of weeks ago about this, and our survey findings tend to say that it's more about our policies there and our recent actions. Public opinion there seems to be sort of down on the U.S. because of multiplicity of factors. One, our military presence has always been a problem. And recent events there have really touched off some disapproval, especially among the younger people there.
So the South Koreans who live next door to you know, that outpost to the Axis of Evil are not not too pleased with the saber rattling?
That's true.
What about U.S. attitudes towards the outside world? How have they changed the last couple of years?
Well, you know, the U.S. Attitudes towards other people sort of have remained the same. Towards Muslim populations, we have gone down. Places like, you know, Turkey and Pakistan, the U.S. tends to view people, you know, less favorably than it has in the past. And in that same period, when our allies, our close allies, you know, rated the U.S. as being sort of unfavorable, you know, the U.S. also said that, you know, Europeans weren't exactly their favorite people at the same time. But, you know, we too gave them a bounce back in the last survey. So it's not, I don't know necessarily that it's a long-term unhealable rift between, you know, outside countries and the U.S., but certainly in a time when the U.S. tends to rally around the flag and, you know, support our troops and go to war, certainly the American people are going to give slightly more unfavorable ratings towards those who don't support us.
And is your sense, do Americans care what the rest of the world thinks of us, or do they just sort of shrug it off as the price of leadership or whatever?
That's an interesting question, actually, one that we've been talking about a lot. And no one's quite sure. There is no perfect measurement on that as of yet. But certainly our policies and the way we go about doing things shows that, you know, we don't necessarily care that much. Although, you know, there are signs, especially from our government, saying that we may need to start caring pretty soon.
What do you mean?
Take, for example, we gauged public opinion about the UN, and for quite some time on our domestic polls, the American people said it was by far much more preferable if we went to war with Iraq, having UN support. But then when we didn't have support, the American people said, well, okay, we're going to support it anyway. And currently, if you ask the American people how they feel about the way things are going, it's a pretty miserable number. You know, the opinion has changed very much in how the public feels about Iraq and the way things are going, and perhaps it's time to do something to enlist the help of our neighbors. And I think the administration also knows this and has felt this, hence the latest word from the White House saying that maybe we do need UN help.
And what about people's feelings of what's happened in Iraq since the formal part of the war ended in April? Is this how do people view what's been happening, the instability there, and U.S. efforts at reconstruction such as they are?
Well, we don't we haven't had any recent polls from abroad on this issue. We do have a couple. In the U.S., it's rapidly gone down from going pretty well to not going so well, which is troubling and something, too, that, I do think that the administration and everyone is starting to look at more, and not just our polls. In fact, Gallup and a couple of other organizations have had interesting polls saying the same thing, that the U.S. public is really, concerned about what's happening in Iraq. They're not happy about it. And to have that going on at the same time when things at home aren't so great, is not something that the U.S. is happy about at all. And that is a point of concern.
Yeah, we have some schools here that could use $87 billion spent on them.
Yes, quite a few schools.
Conclude this segment. The next segment is going to be in part about the Cancun WTO summit. So you also did some work about people's attitudes towards globalization, which is kind of a vague word, hard to define, but
sure.
But also people's attitude towards international trade. And I was a bit surprised at how positive public attitudes abroad were. Could you talk a bit about what you found there?
Yeah, I can. What we found was we asked actually a variety of questions that are really interesting. A large, probably about 25 questions in all, about gauging opinion on international trade in all its various forms. So I hope that maybe on your website you can point people to where we have all of these numbers if they're interested. But on global trade, people were not, they were very supportive of global trade. In fact, 38 of 44 countries that we surveyed said that global trade and business ties were good rather than bad for their country. Now, if you ask them about how they feel about for their families personally, the number is the same. It's gone down a bit, but it's still positive. But it does go down. So there is that sort of personal impact that we saw. It did sort of diminish a bit. Interestingly enough, the developing countries, as you would expect, places like Vietnam and China and Nigeria, places that really haven't had a chance to be out there on the global market, really want trade. They are the highest endorsers of this. And while other places still do support trade in great numbers, you do see small caveats, especially in developed countries. Places like even Western Europe, U.S., Canada, we have more reservations about that than do other countries that sort of almost have nothing to lose.
And also specifically the WTO, there's less hostility than one might have guessed towards the WTO, isn't there?
Yeah, there is support for that. And I think that in a large part this has to do with the fact that they're there. And they're trying to do something, trying to help out in any way possible. If their mission is to try and stimulate global trade, stimulate the economy, it's maybe not necessarily a bad thing.
And finally, I've talked to some people about the globalization poll, but also this is a general Pew exercise, and they've been skeptical about whether your polls had a large enough sample size to be representative of everything. So could you assure people that this is a professionally done poll and that the sample sizes are reasonable?
Sure. I think most people, if they have seen our poll, and I'll just take the time to highly recommend it. We have our website is www.people-press.org. We're a nonprofit organization. We've spent a lot of time and effort, and our survey is quite large. We surveyed the original 44 nation survey was over 38,000 people around the world, and the sample sizes are quite large for polling everywhere. You know, we actually were the largest surveyors of most of these countries. You know, we got 3,000 people in China, which is the largest ever done there. And, you know, there are more and more international polls, and there are a lot of people coming out and saying, well, you know, this is highly urban, this is highly whatever. We have it all in the methodology, and it's published. So I think that it is important to take certain things into account, and I highly recommend it to read it. And, you know, in part, I agree. If we could get a good sample of everyone in Africa and everyone in India, it would be miraculous. But we're still, you know, we're all working on things, and we're doing the best we can, and we've got, you know, I think, great sample sizes, and, you know, there are people in the field working and trudging their way through monsoons for you. I think that's it's a pretty good indication that that it's good, and it can only get better. We look forward to the next one.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. And great. I've been speaking with Nicole Spalda, who is the project director of the Global Attitudes Project at the Pew Center for People in the Press, which is the heir to something founded by the L.A. Times many years ago. And they do lots of polls about public affairs, news, media issues, as well as these international polls. And the website is well worth a visit. You can get all these Global Attitudes. They're right on the front page of the website, and you can link to those and read them yourself. And very interesting stuff. That website, again, people-press.org. Let's listen to a little bit of Dmitry Shostakovich, and then come back with Leslie Kaufman to talk about activism in and around Cancun, the WTO, and also relations of that kind of activism to the peace movement. Was the prelude number 7 in A major by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Keith Jarrett. And now we're joined by Leslie Kaufman, who's an organizer with United for Peace and Justice. Welcome to WBAI, Leslie.
Hi, Doug.
And so let's start with Cancun. United for Peace and Justice is organizing, not necessarily a large presence in Cancun itself, but you've got a lot of activities scheduled around the U.S. Tell us about those.
Yes, well, As your listeners undoubtedly know, the WTO is meeting right now in Cancun, Mexico, with hopes of launching a new round of trade negotiations that, in the hopes of the rich countries, would greatly expand the powers of the WTO. And United for Peace and Justice, along with many other groups in the United States, decided a few months back to respond to a call that came from popular organizations in Mexico to hold solidarity protests during this meeting, with a particular focus on this Saturday, September 13th, as a day of action against globalization and war. So there are now something in the vicinity of 60 to 70 solidarity events being planned all around the United States, ranging from public forums and educational events to quite a number of good-sized protests, marches, tours of shame, that sort of thing, with, again, Saturday really being the focus.
Actually, the previous segment, I spoke with someone from the Pew Center for People in the Press, which does a lot of surveys of attitudes around the world. They report that actually the term globalization is fairly popular in most countries in the world. And specifically in Mexico, 28% of respondents said that trade was very good for the country, and 51% said it was somewhat good. What exactly is UFPJ calling for in your demonstrations around the Cancun summit?
Well, of course, when the United States trade representative says that he supports free trade, that means massive protectionism and subsidies for United States agriculture and steel and domestic industries and rules that require developing countries to open up their economies to floods of imports. I mean, there are clearly many people around the developing world who feel that if there actually were free trade rules in the WTO as opposed to the kind of unequal system of rigged trade barriers that there currently is, that they would in fact be better off. United for Peace and Justice, we began, we are first and foremost an anti-war organization. We're the group that organized the huge anti-war protests on February 15th and began in response to the threat of the war in Iraq. So in some ways, the decision to take up global justice work and to work around the WTO meeting and the meeting coming up in November of the Free Trade Area of the Americas may not seem like an obvious move. But in fact, it's a move that our 650 member organizations have strongly and any controversy decided to back. I mean, the links between war and globalization are widespread and deep. There are both the kind of specific language within trade agreements, like the various agreements that make up the WTO, which create what are called security exceptions, so that the arms industry and defense spending are basically completely unrestricted and unlimited under WTO agreements. So the WTO and the FTAA, if it should pass, help foster the arms race, help foster defense spending, and in fact encourage governments to use the military sector to meet a bunch of goals that are more difficult to meet with other sectors of their economy. But there's also the broader sense of an empire-building agenda by the Bush administration, which has both military and economic facets. And, as I mentioned before, the Bush administration's trade policy is just rife with hypocrisy. It's really about the United States wanting to dictate the terms of the world economy, much as the United States has been hoping to use its military power to dictate terms to much of the world as well. So for all of these reasons, it was a very, though not obvious, a really natural move for United for Peace and Justice to make, to begin working around issues of trade and global justice.
Well, let's talk about some of these activism issues right now, because, we had the global justice movement breaking out like gangbusters, after Seattle, with unprecedented numbers and spirit in the United States, at least. And then that was thrown for a loop by September 11. Then we had an anti-war movement, a very impressive anti-war movement, grow large and quickly in the run-up to the war against Iraq. And now that's more or less disappeared from public view. So what's happened? How do you get these strands of these movements together? I mean, there were certainly a lot of the same people involved in both, but they're different sets of agendas and different organizations and different rhetoric. So how does this all come together?
Well, I think that's very much a work in progress. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, 2 years ago today on September 11th, you know, as of whatever 8:30 in the morning before the first plane hit the World Trade Center, there were, you know, thousands and thousands of people around the United States who were very focused at that time on what was going to be a massive mobilization against the IMF and World Bank in Washington, D.C. in September 2001, a mobilization that ended up, it still technically happened, but it was teeny. It was going to be massive. It was going to be far bigger and more dramatic, probably, even than Seattle, and was going to mark the continued growth of anti-globalization movement that was becoming more sophisticated, was finding ways to accommodate different styles and tactics with less conflict within the movement. And all of that, I mean, it was just like it went up in smoke with the World Trade Center overnight. I mean, it really was very dramatic what happened to all of that energy, and particularly the direct action wing of the movement, which had made, you know, such a splash and created such drama in the streets of Seattle, really disappeared after September 11th. And the anti-war movement, as it developed, had a really, really different character. You know, always the backbone of the anti-war movement were these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of weekly vigils that took place in every teeny little community you can think of around the country. It was really a lot of people who had not been, previously been activists. It was a lot of people who did not necessarily have, you know, a broad critique of capitalism or empire, but who were simply outraged by the moves that the Bush administration was making against Iraq. You know, the anti-war movement was, I mean, there's kind of never been anything in U.S. history that's been comparable in terms of the speed with which this movement developed. I mean, obviously there were many, many groups that had been around, from ranging from Peace Action to the American Friends Service Committee, that had been doing anti-war work for decades. But a lot of what developed really quickly. You know, United for Peace and Justice was only formed in October, and we now have more than 650 member groups around the country, which is a kind of phenomenal number of affiliates. But what you saw with the anti-war movement was you saw a lot of very classic pressure tactics of rallies and vigils and marches. You did not see the kind of confrontational direct action that you saw with the global justice movement. You did not see the kind of carnivalesque flavor that you saw with the global justice movement. And you didn't see the same kind of convergence of many, many issues and agendas in one single fight. It was very much more immediately focused on the immediate threat of war in Iraq. And as you say, after, you know, the end of major fighting in Iraq, the anti-war movement absolutely lost a lot of steam. I mean, it was unquestionably a very sobering fact that despite the millions of people that were out on the street around the world simultaneously on February 15th, the Bush administration went right ahead and invaded Iraq anyway. And it's been difficult to figure out exactly how those of us who are opposed to the Bush administration's policy in Iraq can get traction now.
I'm afraid we're just about out of time, so I'm going to have to close by asking you what kind of events are going on the 13th in New York City.
Yes, absolutely. We are having a parade and festival of resistance to war and corporate rule, which is in solidarity with the WTO protests in Cancun. We're gathering at 1 p.m. on the south steps of Union Square. We will march through Lower Manhattan and end up with a festival in Washington Square Park.
Okay. Thanks for joining us, Leslie Kaufman, who is an organizer with United for Peace and Justice. That again, this Saturday, 1 p.m., south steps of Union Square. And let's go out with the Fugue, number 7, by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Keith Jarrett.